we are going to have a chat amongst ourselves for a little while, and then we're looking very much forward to having questions from the floor. So I'm just putting you all on notice that we will have time for that. And I know that both Christine and Dawn would be more than happy to have a microphone headed in their direction if there are any questions that are raised which really come more to their presentations. But we did hear that Australia Post was a model of Victorian bureaucratic efficiency, which I thought was rather good. And we did find this picture of Australia Post, which we thought we might pop up, just to remind ourselves about what that actually looked like. Actually, it isn't really Australia Post. And Jody, thank you very much for this. I'm not sure exactly what that photo came from, but that is definitely not where the future of work is going to be taking us in Australia today. But Christine, you did talk about seismic shifts, amazing, you know, percentage changes, billions of this and millions of that, and 30% increases in the number of parcels carried by the posties and so on and so forth. So these are huge challenges. And one of the first things that happened at our table was we started to contemplate, and led very much by Chris Sutherland, about, well, really, how big is this change? What does it really mean? So Naveen, I wonder if you might like to kick off and perhaps, you know, help us to think about just really how big these challenges are. Get us a bit grounded in fact and set some context for the conversation.
Sure. Thanks, Diane. But I do want to call out, it's great to be the token male on a panel. Also, in light of Christine's comments, right, men are endangered in the workplace, So I think the future of work is obviously a really interesting topic. And we as McKinsey globally have been looking at this for about 4 or 5 years. And more recently, we did a piece of work on Australia, just understanding what the future of work could look like in Australia. I think there's just two or three facts just to ground ourselves. The first is jobs don't go, tasks do, right? So we all have work, and as part of our daily routines, as things we do, they potentially get automated. And they have been getting automated since time immemorial, right? Things do get better and productivity improves. But there are a few things that are different this time around. I think the first thing we'd say is the percentage of automation and the speed at which it's coming is a lot higher. So our estimates are about 25 to 45% of all activities will be automated by 2030. That's a lot in a very, very short period. And this, I'm just talking about Australia. So essentially what we did was we looked at all the roles, we kind of broke them up into activities, and then we looked at each activity and said, how automatable is it given current technology and predicted kind of future technology? So that was the basis for the estimation. But imagine a quarter to half of what you do will be automated. So then that begs the question, what does it mean for us? What it means is a workforce that has been transitioning so far, so you've always had transitions in workforces, that transition pace accelerates a lot, and it goes up anywhere between 1.5 to 3 times. So you can imagine the velocity of people moving in and out of jobs goes up dramatically. So what? You're going to lose a lot of jobs, but you're going to gain a lot of jobs because the types of jobs are going to change. The good news is our estimates say you're actually going to be up about 500,000 jobs by the end of it all. So you're going to lose about 3.6 million, and you're going to gain about 4.1 million, which is the good news. The less good news is those transitions are hard because by our estimate, predictable physical work, predictable mental work, and cognitive skills work will go. And this goes to the point that, Christine, you made. The biggest job losses are going to be in places like in your postal, in the warehouses, where those are predictable physical jobs, those are going to go. And more jobs are going to go in interaction, management, those types of roles, creative roles. And the challenge is going to be in that transition, you're not going to necessarily have a like for like. The person who's doing the predictable physical role isn't necessarily the person who can do the other role. So by our estimate, unemployment could go up half to a full percentage point. And in the Australian context, where unemployment has traditionally been quite low, that's a significant jump. And that's especially in the transition. So that's the first big implication. The second big implication is, as you think about those skill sets, the question is, where are those skill sets? And where are the skill sets in today's employees and in the future? And all our research shows the skill sets that you need in the future are social and emotional skill sets. We don't necessarily look for those or train for those. We look for cognitive skill sets in most cases. And in interaction skills, in how well I can empathize and work with other people. Very different from what you need in the future, from what we have now. And I guess the last point, and this is the one that keeps me awake at night. I'm very much a glass half full guy. I look at the personal growth and opportunity. But the biggest implication with the relevance for those skills is inequality. We expect inequality will go up when we estimate. And the question is, how much? Because those skill sets that are being looked at are not necessarily skill sets of the folks who are losing the job. So there will be an issue in terms of inequality. And I think there is a challenge for all of us as a society and as companies on how we're going to manage the transition to a world that feels less unequal. So the good news is more jobs. The not so good news is, how do you manage that transition in a way that it doesn't affect society at large?
Thanks very much, Naveen. I think that sets some really good context for us and lines very much up with what we heard from Dawn and Christine before. I think for many of us, it might have been a little confronting to hear, you know, when you're in Western Australia, where we think about hazardous work, high-risk work, the mining industry. You know, I see some folk from the Water Corp here, a lot of confined space work done in that environment. To hear Christine go, well, one of the most dangerous jobs that you can have in Australia is being a postie. And this is something that Anthea and I spend a bit of time worrying about. You know, what is the new nature of work going to do to our safety profile? Will there be safe for work? You know, what are going to be the implications overall? So, Anthea, perhaps you might like to talk about that. And it really does hark to something that Dawn said about people wanting to have agency over their own lives. However, with agency comes responsibility and a bit of stress. So I think we might hear from you about this as well in terms of the psychosocial nature of change.
Sure. Thanks, Diane. Is it possible to click to the next slide? So at Safe Work Australia, we had a look at the future of work, and we did this in consultation with the Data 61 team at CSIRO. And the work that the report that we produced focused on six mega trends or big changes that we're expecting to see. And a lot of those are things that Christine spoke about, are challenges that she's currently facing as well. So in terms of potential benefits, opportunities, certainly things like automated systems or the introduction of robotics can make workplaces safer and eliminate some of the current hazards and risks, you know, getting the posties off the bikes perhaps. But there's also some potential other unintended consequences or perverse outcomes that we need to think about. And certainly another megatrend that we focused on was the rising workplace stress and mental health amongst workers. So I think it's been estimated that almost a third of workers at the moment are experiencing some form of workplace stress. Some of the other trends that we looked at also point to pressures in terms of stress. So things like blurring boundaries between work and home, the gig economy, you know, insecure jobs, the ageing workforce. Is it going to be, you know, challenging for older workers to adapt to a new way of working and the introduction of new technologies in their workplace? So in terms of some of those, you know, psychological impacts. We've got some data here as well that looks at the actual cost of psychological health and safety, and it's quite staggering, really. So the figure down the bottom, I just wanted to call out in terms of lost productivity and presenteeism. I think it's $6 billion per annum. It's pretty phenomenal, and that's obviously only looking at things from that lens. And when you factor in those broader social costs and impacts, it's quite huge. In terms of, I suppose, the situation here in WA, we've also got some data that looks at these stress-related claims. On the next slide.
I did ask. Here it comes.
It's coming. And in terms of performance at the moment, WA actually looks pretty good. They're below the national average in terms of stress-related claims. But certainly with the changing nature of work, it's something that we expect to see change and continue to change. And so employers really need to turn their minds to how they can protect workers' psychological health and safety and during that process.
Okay, thanks very much, Anthea. Jody, I think you're in a pretty unique position because you've been someone that's actually gone through a change like this. And I couldn't help but when Dawn talked about what a data-rich state we are, to think, well, you were dealing in a particularly data-rich government department at Landgate. So if you could tell us a little bit about the journey that you took that department through and how it plays into these themes that we've heard from Naveen and Anthea.
Sure, yeah, happy to. And I acknowledge my my colleague from Landgate, Julianne, who's here in the audience today. I was certainly one of a team that took Landgate on a massive journey. And I guess the thing I'd say off the top is that it's a marathon, not a sprint. If you think that you can walk into a business and turn it around into, into an Amazon or a Google, and I've got a story about Google. Are there any Google people in the room before I tell my Google story? you actually need to start right at the beginning. So from a Landgate perspective, we would argue at Landgate that exploration is in our DNA. We're actually the Lands Surveys Office, and while AusPost is very old, Landgate's the oldest government agency in WA. So 1829, we were formed. And it was full of explorers. So we were really lucky that we actually had that as our background, and I think it stood us in really good stead for the future. So you start all of these changes with culture, you start all of these changes with people, and you have to invest, and it's not an easy thing, and sometimes people, I often say in my job, my job would be fantastic, and then people, because people are tough. They're tough. We're hard. And you have to, the blurring lines between work and home. So Landgate embarked on a journey 10 years ago, became a commercial statutory authority under the guidance of Graham Searle, who was the CEO, who saw a way that the agency could deliver more to the state than just being rolled up into becoming an arm of the Department of Planning and Infrastructure, because that's what was going to happen, and really cut its own future. And, fast forward to today, where we've got an innovative agency, a 10-year-old innovation program, the first of its kind in Australia, that's been very successful, and the government has made the decision that they're going to look to commercialise a part of the Landgate business, which could potentially bring, $1 billion+ into the state. So it's a big journey, but that's a 10-year journey. And I would say at Landgate, I'd say we're only just beginning, but I'm not there anymore, but I feel like I'm always there. So I think we're still just beginning there. So it's been an exciting story, but it is a slow burn, and you have to put people first, and culture matters. Culture matters. You can't say it enough. It's really important.
So one of the mega trends that Anthea showed on her page was this blurring of the boundaries between work and home. And I think the public service has always had a very flexible approach to work. I'm interested in our panel's views on how are we going to actually make those changes, because, the work environment can be one that can't really be controlled by the employer. So we're thinking, okay, we can remove some of the unsafe work, but then we've got people unsupervised at home. What was your experience with that, Jody?
Yeah, look, Landgate was a very flexible employer and still is. I think it's patchy across the public sector. I think there are some who do it better than others. But I actually don't think we're anywhere near ready for the flexibility of the future. So if I ask my 17-year-old how he wants to work, and he currently has an online job which he does from his bedroom, so unless he falls out of bed, he's unlikely to cause himself an injury. But his view of work, he thinks I'm insane to get up in the morning and, leave home at 7 and come back at 6. He thinks that's nuts. So we're not actually ready for the flexibility that the next generation wants. They want to work whenever they feel like it, to not be locked into anything, You know, many of them don't want cars. If you look at the stats, I think it's a very small percentage that see themselves driving. So they want to be able to work from home. They want to be able to hook up with their friends. So the flexibility that we in this room talk about, and I look around the room and we're of a certain age, you know, is not the flexibility that businesses need to gear up for the future. And I think that will be the real challenge, because the gig economy, the app society, the where things are going, if we think about our work context now, we're already behind the eight ball, I think, in terms of flexibility.
Naveen, do you want to lean in on this? Because yeah. I know that McKinsey itself is having to face into all of this stuff. You
for
know,
sure.
I mean, I was at McKinsey, left about 10 years ago, and I am just startled at how the firm, which is what we insiders call it, the firm, just like the movie, has, you know, revitalised itself. So talk about some of those crazy people that I met in the
sure.
hallways.
I think I just want to build on what Jody said, because a lot of the work that we're doing now, we're seeing that work design is important and work design is archaic. So, I mean, like you go into a conversation about digital and, wow, people can't use digital. And I go, but they use Uber all the time or they use Facebook. They can use a million tools. But we get to the workforce, we get to the workplace, and it still feels like we've just kind of gone in one of those cars and back to the future. It just feels like you're back in time, right? And that for me is one of the things that we haven't really invested in, because you can't put dollars on it, but you kind of can, because that's what productivity is about. And one of my favorite examples was a warehouse where they did what they call inventory cycle counting. So you actually literally go and count the parts and then you write it on a sheet of paper. And like, seriously, it was like the 70s, right? I mean, and then you'd go back. No, it was not the 70s. It was the 80s, because they had computers. Then they'd go back and then they'd punch it in. There'd be an error and then it was something else. And these were folks who were in their 50s. Like, they weren't buzz, like buzzy about words and so on. But when you ask them, what is it you want to see? They could tell you. Because they know what good systems look like, good tools look like, because they're interacting with tools all around them. And then you say, okay, how do you redesign your work? And they're excited. And you see that whole excitement come out, because otherwise they're just, you know, doing something that they've always been doing. And then when you redesign it, and it doesn't take that long, but you have to invest in it. And then you see how they work. And you just free up so much creativity, because they're not doing drudgy tasks. And so what they're now doing is not inventory cycle counting, but they're saying, okay, how do we get this inventory here faster? What happens? How do you get a refill done? They're thinking, right? And for me, that's the part that I find most exciting about what we could do. We have all these tools and systems available at our fingertips, but we aren't redesigning how work is done. And then I think we can be more flexible. Then I think we can get more thinking done versus the predictable tasks that we're doing right now.
Yeah, this work design piece, you know, Safe Work says very clearly, Anthea, that good work design sits at the very top of the hierarchy of risk controls. You know, and let's face it, I think Naveen is absolutely spot on. The people that are in the process will know about it the best. And I think we often underestimate just how effective people can be in redesigning their work. But I think Safe Work has a lot to say about this and has a lot of guidance on the website as well. You might want to give it a plug.
Yeah, sure. So, yes, we do have a lot of information available on our website about good work design. We've got a good work design handbook and principles. We also have lots and lots of codes of practice that, you know, provide information about how employers can and meet their duties under work health and safety laws. I think definitely prevention is better than cure when it comes to safe work design. But I think an interesting point that's kind of cropping up is, you know, who is actually responsible here in terms of workplaces. And when you look at things like the gig economy, there's been lots of discussion recently about, well, who is the PCBU with the duties? Where is the workplace? And I think that also connects with the piece around, you know, flexible work arrangements. It might not be at home now. It could be, you know, on the bus or on a plane. I mean, there's so many different work sites. So I think it's definitely coming back to the actual design of how work is done is a really good anchor to ensure that that work is safe.
Mm. It's a really interesting question. At Wesfarmers, there's a lot of work now being done to automate the high-risk work. I talked before about the Water Corp guys having confined space, and they have very similar stuff down at the naval base in the chemicals business, where now they're doing all the inspections of the tanks using a drone. A drone does a much better job of getting into little nooks and crannies and looking behind pipes and so forth. And, of course, it's much safer because you don't have to send a person harnessed up inside one of those vessels. So the question then, because if it is possible to do the work in that way, if the person who's responsible for the business undertaking chooses not to use some of these new tools, are they actually meeting the test? Are they designing the work well enough? I think this is going to be a big question for many of us. Now, I think we might turn to you, our audience, to see what's really on your mind. We've got some roving microphones here. So does anyone have a question for our panel? We got one. It's hard, a little bit hard to see. CETA audiences are supposed to work for their lunch. But in the meantime, you know, maybe, Jody, tell us a little bit about the data that Landgate had and how that actually got out into creating actually some new jobs in WA.
Sure. Look, there is a slide somewhere, Diane, if you've got your
sure, we can find it. I've got the famous clicker.
Look, one of the things that Landgate has done in automating its registry business and other parts of its business is it has focused on the data. So Landgate, for its sins, has ownership of data.wa.gov.au, where you can find thousands of government data sets available, many for free, not only of Landgate data, but obviously all sorts of data. And our view in launching Spur, which is an innovation and data hub, was if we make this data available and make people available to startups to have conversations with, then businesses can grow on the back of it. So we do it in a number of ways. See, I'm still doing the we. I'm just going to do the we for this session. So how we do that is we, through a number of methods, but we have grants that we give startups. But more importantly, and what startups value the most, is time with people who understand the data. So Landgate's foundation data sets are about location, and then we have many other things from Bureau of Statistics, from planning data, from transport data, police, marine data, agriculture data, all available through one spot. And our argument is, particularly for the app economy, when you're designing an app, everything happens somewhere. So location becomes such a foundation data set for everything. So giving startups access to these people who really know the data well has spawned a lot of new businesses. And we're really proud to say that, you know, there are companies that, like Power Ledger, who we've helped, and there's fintech companies that are doing really exciting things, as well as location-based companies. There's Space2Co, who are recently on the Shark Tank. I think they said being on Shark Tank was less scary than talking to me, so, you know, that's probably a good thing. But there's all of these fantastic new technologies that are out there that Landgate, by making government data, which we already collect, available for people, we grow businesses, and you know, that's really important for the economy.
Okay, I think we've got a question from Nicole Lockwood down here. So I was going to say, do the normal thing, you know, name, rank and serial number.
Thanks.
Over to you.
So I'm chairing the Westport Task Force. So our job is to look long-term, 50 to 100 years, at port-related futures, freight supply chain. Obviously, this is right in the thick of everything we're talking about. Been to a few different seminars like this talking about whose role is it to lead this, because we've got, you know, I'm here on the invitation of University of Western Australia, so there's a university role and there's lots of debate about what we're churning out in terms of graduates. Then there's a question about industry. Do they need to anticipate it? What's government's role? We're trying to come up with a strategy that says, look, this is what you're going to have to anticipate. Who do we point to?
Naveen, do you want to have a crack at that first?
I could. I'll give my fellow panelists some time to think. I'll take a crack at that, because I think the best governments are taking a role in this. I think that's the way I'd answer it. Because if you look at, this is an externality, because everybody is interested, but not everybody is invested. So the best way to do an externality is you need some form of governmental intervention. the best governments, I think of Singapore, I think of some of the Scandinavian countries, are getting ahead of thinking about this at a governmental level. And they're thinking about the implications at that level. So Germany, 3-4 years ago, started investing far more in vocational education and took out a lot of their tertiary degrees or morphed them into more vocational types of degrees. So I think governments do have a pivotal role to play, to be very honest. And then if the governments don't play a role, then the question becomes, who else? I think corporates have a pretty critical role. And I'm looking at some of the corporates in this room because I think eventually it's an opportunity if corporates can play, because it's important for them from a business and long-term shareholder return standpoint, but also important for society that they play that role. So I do think government has a role to play. The question is, will they step up, not step up? And then if not, the large corporates for sure should play a role there.
I've probably got a variation on a theme, Nicole. I think it's actually a collaborative space. And I think one thing that's happening in the current economy is almost everything is about collaboration, and everything is done better if we collaborate. And whether that's universities collaborating together, which traditionally hasn't always worked very smoothly, or government agencies, which often are just as, you know, you may as well just as well tell the big miners to collaborate. You think that we do, but we don't do it particularly well. We're getting better at it. I think the power of collaboration is absolutely the way of the future, or else we're just not going to get done in the time frame that we have to do things. So I think we're getting better at it, and you've probably seen a bit of that in that Westport role. But if it's not collaborative, it's doomed to failure, is my view.
Yeah, I think these are two really important perspectives that we'd heard. I would add something which very much aligns up with what Christine Holgate said in her keynote, because certainly my personal experience in working in the private sector with large groups of people is if you are grounded in care for your employees, if you actually care about your people and what their career might look like and what their life might look like, then you're going to get ahead of this problem as an employer. And so I think if we've got government setting a frame, we've got collaboration between government, educational institutions and employers, but the employers actually caring about their people, then we'll probably land in a good spot. Now, I think we've got another question.
Right here.
Gordon.
Gordon Flake with the Perth US Asia Centre at UWA. I realize this is probably broadening the discussion too much, but it seems impossible for me to have the discussion like we've just had in a hermetically sealed national bubble. You know, Australia just hit 25 million people. And so I really would like to ask the panel about demography, immigration, and the issues you've discussed it. Because if you're looking at the challenges that we're facing today, Australia just hit 25 million people in August. These issues won't be handled within Australia alone. It's going to be overlaid with questions of immigration, overlaid with questions of whether you outsource or not. And I would just kind of add to the complexity of that by noting that domestically, in democracies, you know, the issues that you've discussed in terms of technology have always been harder for political leaders to digest, and they've always gone towards the easier targets of you know, demonizing, again, immigrants and for free trade, and yet you can't address the challenges of, as Christine mentioned, of a workforce where, you know, 35% of the workforce retires in the next 5 years, without kind of overlaying these other issues, that technology alone doesn't address them. So, I realize that's a big question, but I thought we needed to broaden the discussion a little bit to pull those into it. So.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. I mean, that is a real broadening of it, but I do think it is important to think about the global aspect, and we heard a bit about that from Christine, but I have to take issue with you at suggesting there's no political leadership in Australia these days. What were you thinking? Who'd like to have a crack at this? I have some thoughts. Shall I pop those in? Why don't I start? You know, I think the whole notion of globalisation, I think sometimes Australian companies, you know, we do get a lot of conversation that we're not particularly good at going global. And so there is a bit of a tendency to say, well, okay, look, let's not worry about that global market. We are 25 million people now after all said and done. You know, it's a reasonably decent domestic market. I can still have a great job, a great profit and a great future for my company just looking at Australia. This is so far away from what I believe is the right answer. Because with a globalised world, even if we decide that we are only going to address the Australian market, if our offering isn't globally competitive, there is absolutely nothing that is going to stop our customer from accessing a better offering from somewhere else. And Christine Holgate's posties are going to put it on the back of that new electric motorbike and bring it to your front door. So I do think we have to, as Australian companies, as Australian governments, educational institutions, stand up and actually stop this business of looking into the middle of Australia, turn around, look over the blue water and look at what is going on in the rest of the world. Otherwise, we will find that the jobs that are left for our people to do are not very exciting and not very many. And I think this will play in a vein to your comments about the potential for there to be greater inequality if we don't handle these changes effectively. Other thoughts?
Can I just say, as an immigrant, I'm biased, right? So, I mean, how do I answer that question without indicating my bias? I would just say it's a complex issue. I'm not the expert by any means. But I kind of go, this is an amazing state, amazing country. We have such opportunities. If we expanded our vision to say, how could we serve some of these global opportunities? I mean, you described safety. And one of the things that Woodside, as many of you may know, is pioneering is robots in the Northwest, where they have their big LNG facilities. The temperatures go up about 50 degrees, and they're using robots to do the safe work. And that is an incredibly innovative thing that we should be taking to the world. And that's just one of 100 innovations. I mean, we talked about Spur and at Landgate. And for me, that's the opportunity. I think if we take the opportunity lens to how big this could be, I think we have a lot more that we can do. So that's the first point. The second, I think immigration and all of those are touchstones for politics, not just here, but globally, because they're easy to name and you can call something. What do you do for technology? How do you say it's, because I think there is, if I really had to say what's happening, technology and automation is happening, but it's kind of a faceless villain. And so it's much harder to call out. And I think it's up to all of us. I genuinely think it's up to all of us to kind of call that out, because there is something happening here that is a far bigger trend than immigration, which I think is being called out for things that are not due to it, right? So I do feel like there's a bit of a naming this here when something else is happening there. And I think us and politics, but also business leaders, to take the onus to call it for what it is and then act proactively in kind of making a change. I think that's important.
I think it gets very political. I think world economics at the moment is scary. World politics is scary in terms of the rise of what we're seeing, nationalism and all of those sorts of things. You know, if you don't learn the lessons from history, you are bound to repeat them, which I think is kind of worrying. I think we need to get our act together on immigration. But I think before we can do that, we need to look at sustainability, because if you're bringing in more people into this country, we have water that's, well, in Sydney you can get all your water in 10 seconds. But you know, we have water shortages. We haven't done power well. We've got a nation that should be run on solar energy. I still don't understand how any house is built in WA without a solar roof. I mean, you can get solar glass now, for God's sake. So we need to look at how we would, with our limited resources on a fragile environment, we need to look at how we would take more people into this country. And I believe we absolutely should. But it's about world collaboration. And I agree, if we don't do it ourselves, the posties will be delivering everything from Amazon.com on the back of a bike. So we are in a global economy, and I think, you know, we need to play a leadership. The flip side of that is, I would say all of us need to not be hostage to the media, because the media, you know, can sometimes play the sensationalist line, and certainly in the public sector and the private sector, people get burnt with the media over, you know, a story that really is a headline one day. And I think it's up to all of us to actually demand good journalism from our media. And I'm not saying all media, but there's certainly some areas that, you get so you don't want to stick your head up and say anything or do anything different just in case. So I think that's our role as a society to, you know, to actually look with intelligence at these things and take it in a measured way. That's my view.
Thanks, Jody. Well said. I think we have time for one last question, which we're going to get from the back of the room here.
Lucky last, Doug Mackay from Hudson Executive. I just wanted to take that point and run with it a little bit in terms of the interaction between the economy and the labour force. Australia's got one of the most expensive labour forces globally, and obviously with further immigration, further population growth, because Australia's a great place to live. What do you see as Western Australia's advantages in terms of the interaction between labour and economy to attract labour to work in Australia and work in Western Australia for the future?
That is a great question. Anthea, you're probably going to get let off this, given you're not a West Australian, unless you particularly want to lead in on this one. Have any thoughts on it? No, we're going to leave it to the locals.
Again, I'm not a local. I am now.
But you are a local
I am now.
You're not going
but that's,
anywhere,
I'm
going
to start with that because when I moved here from India about 7 years ago, so I was a consultant in India. I moved to the same company 7 years ago to set up an office in Perth. I'd never been to Australia. We landed here, right? And people ask me, you mean you didn't go to Sydney and kind of get Australianized and then come to Western Australia? And I said, no, we just showed up, right? I mean, what's not to like about the WACA? So I said, yes. So we came here and I started serving clients here and I was amazed because I work with a lot of Indian companies and I work with a lot of companies that really had amazing ambition, incredible hunger to get to great places but didn't have the resources, just didn't have the people, didn't have the money, what have you. But they had vision and they really wanted, there was a hunger that I could find. And I don't mean to offend anybody, but I found the opposite here. I found incredible resources, but just not enough hunger because it's a great place. Like it's a really nice place. I love my life here. I love the beaches and I love all of that. But there was a bit of the we can keep going. And what I found practically and personally as a consultant is when I worked with organizations where that hunger was unlocked, they did amazing things. World best here in Australia and Western Australia. So I felt that it was more about unlocking and saying, what greatness do we want to achieve? Because when that happened, we had everything and more in spades. And I just don't make that, this is a very serious statement of fact, that I don't think we're lacking in anything. I think we beat ourselves up a hell of a lot. I was in Bangkok yesterday and amazed at the journey I did there to get from my hotel to the airport. And I said, wow, if only I was in Perth. This would be a 15-minute. Like the things we have here are incredible. I think the question is, do we have the hunger? Do we care about being great? And if we do, it's ours to have.
Jody, you want to have a go?
I'll have a go. Look, I think we have many fantastic things here. We have an amazing climate. We have fantastic natural resources. We have the oldest Indigenous culture in the world, which we don't make anywhere near enough song and dance about or give support to or use as a tourist attraction. We have obviously our industries, our mining industries. We have fantastic agriculture. We have, you know, open space. You know, what I think we lack, I think we can be a bit complacent. So I agree with you, Naveen. I think we've got it pretty good. And I think if you look statistically, we're probably in about the top 5% of the world for standard of living. So I think that makes us all a little bit complacent. And maybe we haven't been out and looked at places where things are done differently. But I think the biggest thing we've got going for us in WA, and I'm parochial and I think my family's been here about 8 generations since they came out in the 1800s, is that we think differently. We actually think differently and our isolation has made us think differently. And that's fantastic because we are very different to the other side of the country, much to their disgust. And I think the other thing, public servants don't usually get political. But, you know, the other thing I would say at the moment, I've been in the public sector 20 years, we have a state government who actually genuinely has vision. And it's the first time I've seen a state government with vision outside of an election cycle in 20 years. So I'm kind of agnostic who's in. I just want someone good in. But I do think we have a state government with vision. So I think that's what we've got going for us.
Thank you. That's a great way to end our panel. For those of you that were thinking before, as Naveen was giving context, wow, I wish I could quickly trap all of those fact figures and statistics. Here they are. Feel free to take a picture of it. Gives you all in one easily digestible infographic the context around. Look, see Naveen, look at that. Photo's being taken. Rowena, I think I'm handing over to you. Thanks very much, panellists. This was, you made it very easy.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you, Diane, and thank you for facilitating a terrific discussion today. My name's Rowena Allbones, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Rio Tinto Iron Ore. Before I start, can I just take the opportunity to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Wadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. On behalf of Rio Tinto and CEDA, I'd like to thank all of our speakers and panellists today for a lively discussion around the future of work. I was particularly interested to hear Christine Holgate describe how Australia Post, an organisation that has been around for more than 200 years, is now reimagining itself and its journey towards growth. Like Australia Post, Rio Tinto and other miners here today are often described as the old economy, but as we have learned, it's these organisations that need to think the most about change and adaptation. I'd also like to thank our panellists today, Jody Kant, Director General, West Australian Department of Finance, Naveen Uni, Managing Partner of Perth for McKinsey, and Anthea Raven, Acting Branch Manager, Strategic Policy Branch, SafeWork Australia. Each of you brought an interesting perspective to the discussion, and you certainly got me thinking about the future of work through a different lens. Thank you very much. I think we all recognise that we are facing a period of incredible change. It's great to see some of the leading companies in Western Australia also considering the challenges and opportunities the change will bring. So important is the future of work to the business community that CEDA thought to put on not one, not two, but three of these events dedicated to the subject. And Rio Tinto was very proud to sponsor all three of the entire series. Over the series, we've heard much about the future of technology, and there certainly have been some exciting predictions about advances in this space. But despite all the analysis and discussion about automation, connected machines, self-driving cars, robotics, and big data, I'm really glad that today we focused on people. From Rio Tinto's perspective, it's the ingenuity of our people that will enable the technological advances. That's why we're taking a people-first approach to reskilling, upskilling, and redeployment, ensuring we're ready for changes that are shaping jobs right across our organisation. We're very fortunate to have heard Christine's perspective today. She's responsible for 70,000 people through enormous change, and I'm really encouraged to hear her vision and see her energy and also her care for people, which I think is a really important part of leadership. And Australia Post is not alone. We, like many of you, are on a similar journey. For a company that has been mining for almost 150 years, you might be surprised to find that Rio Tinto is one of the world's largest investors in modern technology and process innovation. In fact, many of our largest breakthroughs have been led from Australia by Australians. We're currently automating our trains, our trucks, our drills, and have heavily invested in transforming our business to stay ahead of technology. We're also planning our first intelligent mine, Koodaideri. This will be the most technologically advanced mine in Rio Tinto's portfolio, and we announced final investment approval for this project this morning. Of course, it's a huge investment in technology and will deliver a safer and more productive operation. But as everyone in this room will understand, it's an even bigger investment in our people, in communicating change, in recruiting new people, in training capabilities as we upskill and reskill a generation of workers. And while we've been talking to our employees for over a decade about how technology and automation changes roles and creates new opportunities, we need to make sure that this conversation connects with a broader cross-section of the community. As the pace of technological change accelerates, many in our community are understandably asking themselves what the jobs of the future will be and how they can prepare themselves and their children for the changing nature of work across industries and not just in mining. I hope that with today's discussion and the panel and the presentations that we've heard, we're all now in a slightly better position to tell this story. When you leave this room, I'd ask each of you to help strengthen the understanding of automation and innovation and its expected impact on the work and the opportunities for the communities that we live in. So I'd like to ask you to join me to thank today's speakers and everyone who's contributed to the series. Thank you.